All right, so I got to tell you, since day one, it has been my goal on this podcast to bring you guests from all walks of baseball, men and women at the very top of their game, the best players like Cal Ripken Jr., Johnny Bench, Brooks Robinson, and Ozzie Smith, the best broadcasters like John Miller and Bob Costas, the best organists like Nancy Faust, the best ballpark architect, Janet Marie Smith, bat boys, umpires, clubhouse managers. And from the beginning, there was one man from the world of groundskeeping that I wanted to have on this podcast. And believe me, I tried for months to reach him. Phone calls, emails, going through every contact I had to try to connect with him. And I couldn't. But this week, I finally did. And what follows is one of my favorite episodes. George P. Toma is my guest on this episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The F&M Shaver Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And there should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. So pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold shaver or two throughout the evening.
If you were building a Mount Rushmore of groundskeepers, and you only had space for one, there would be no hesitation. The man you would etch in the granite of that mountain would be George P. Toma. George Toma, who is 94 years young today, has been doing groundskeeping since he was 12 years old. Now, if like me, math is not your strong suit, that's 82 years. The man nicknamed the Sod Father and the Nitty Gritty Dirt Man has been responsible for the playing surface at the Super Bowl for 50-some years. Day-to-day, he was the head groundskeeper in Kansas City at Municipal Stadium and then later at Royal Stadium, and has advised and been a part of the grounds installation and upkeep at more ballparks and stadiums than we can mention in the length of this podcast episode. He also supervised the 84 and 96 Olympics, the 94 World Cup, and well into his ninth decade of living, he still consults. George Toma, welcome to the Lost Ballparks podcast.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for spending a little bit of time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm 94 years old, so I don't have nothing else to do.
Listen, George, when I called you a couple of days ago when we first connected, someone was trying to install either sod in your yard or your neighbor's yard, and I was just thinking to myself, how intimidating would that job be for that person or that group of people trying to lay sod while the best whoever did it, you, looks on to make sure they're doing it right?
Well, two neighbors put in sod this week, but I would never put it down.
See, that's what I mean.
The base wasn't level, and there was a lot of rocks in it, but probably they'll have the best grass on the block.
So, George, where did you get your start in groundskeeping? Where did that happen?
Well, actually, I started working at Artillery Park for the Wilkes-Barre Barons, which was a Cleveland Indians farm club. And I was 12 years old at that time.
And what year would that have been?
42, Eastern League. Scranton was a Red Sox, you know, and Pittsburgh was at Williamsport. Yankees were at Binghamton, things like that.
So here you are at Artillery Park in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, which is said to, I think, have been the site of Babe Ruth's longest home run, right?
Yes, it's almost 600 feet, I think. I have it written down. There's a monument there.
When Bill Veeck purchased the Cleveland Indians, that's when you got your big break.
Right. I worked with my neighbor, Stan Scheckler, who taught me. My father died when I was 10 years old from working in mines, anthracillicosis, black lung disease. So got a job with him and worked with him. And then when I was 16 years old, Bill Veeck bought the Cleveland Indians, and he bought like Wilkes-Barre, Oklahoma City, you know, Dayton, Ohio, and things like that. And he made the groundkeeper the head trainer because he had training experience. And I was a senior in high school, 16 years old, and he made me the head groundskeeper.
Wow. So at 16, you're the head groundskeeper at
Artillery Park.
The amazing part about what you did at Artillery Park when you worked in the minors, not only did you have to take care of the field, But, George, you were also responsible for cleaning up trash underneath the seats, dusting and cleaning the dugouts and the press box. You even, at some point, handled posting the balls and strikes on the scoreboard.
That's right. Actually, there was just me and Jimmy Mazzillo. We were both the same age. And we had to get the field ready, sweep the grandstand, and we had a help or something. But we had to clean up underneath the bleachers. We had to clean the press box, the dugout, and do the restrooms. And then I would watch the field during the game, and Jimmy Mazzillo would go to right center where the big scoreboard was, and it was like a stop signs, red, green, and for balls and strikes, he was faster than the umpires.
And I think, and you probably wouldn't have counted this as work or part of your job. In fact, it probably would be considered a benefit or a perk, but you would sometimes pitch batting practice. In fact, didn't you pitch to Rocky Colavito?
Yes, we would throw to Rocky Colavito.
Well, Rocky Colavito, it certainly is a great pleasure to have you with us. And certainly the way that you've been wrapping that apple around, there are many records still ahead of you, which I'm sure you'll take care of.
Rocky would come out about every morning. About 11 o'clock to take a little batting practice.
Yeah, so Rocky Colavito came up in the Indians minor league system and before he eventually got called up. So you would have seen him at Artillery Park when you were the head groundkeeper there. And then you were reunited in Kansas City at Municipal Stadium when he was a member of the Kansas City A's. And he was a good player.
He was a great, great ball player, you know what I mean? And had a great arm. And then Charlie O'Finley owned the ball club at that time. And they had a Brings truck in center field during the games that if he hit so many home runs, they're so, he's getting so much money, and the money was in the Brings truck.
All right, so I remember hearing about this in 1964 at Kansas City's Municipal Stadium. Rocky Colavito was going for, I think, trying to hit his 300th home run. And Charlie Finley, who, of course, owned the team at the time, in an effort to draw people in to watch Rocky chase 300 home runs, he parked a Brinks truck beyond the outfield wall with 300 silver dollar coins that he was going to give to Rocky once he hit that home run. I totally forgot about that. That's such a great story. And you were there for it.
Right.
Now, a lot of folks, myself included, would say, George, that you are the greatest groundskeeper in history, in baseball history. But you would say it was Emil Bossert who you work for.
Right. He was the greatest groundkeeper that I ever known. And he can do anything. I mean, he grow that grass. He had the best pitching mound. He had the best infield dirt. And I started to work with him back in 1948. I was at Wilkes-Barre, but the war was over, and all these lot of major league clubs would go in and take over deactivated Army, Navy, Air Force bases. They would build fields like when I would amble down the Driver, Virginia, right outside of Suffolk, and build a couple fields there at a Naval Air Station, and they used officer barracks for quarters. And then in 49, we went down to Georgia at an Air Force base, built some fields. And what I remember about that one most, we had some fields down there, and Oklahoma City was a farm club, and they had an exhibition game. And Joe Vosmick was the manager, and Minnie Minoso was on the team. And they're having an exhibition game, playing spring training, and the bases were loaded. It was 3-0 count, and Joe Vosmick gave Minnie the take sign. Minnie didn't take it. He hit a grand slam home run. So when he came back to dugout, Joe Vosmick says, "Didn't you see I gave you the take sign?" He said, "Yeah, me take for four."
Did he really?
Yeah, me take for four. And then in 1950, we built six fields down at Daytona Beach. That's where the Daytona 500 is now. And in 1950, I went to the Korean War. And I went for a couple of years in Korea and then came back.
Thank you so much for your service, George. There are so many members of the baseball community throughout history who have served in wars and conflicts, and we are forever grateful for your service. So in 1957, you become the head groundskeeper for the Kansas City A's at Municipal Stadium.
Spacious Municipal Stadium,
one of the most modern in the game. This giant arena was built in record time when the A's came to town.
Huge job for you, and you're coming from where? Where were you at that point before Municipal Stadium?
I was working for the Tigers in Charleston, West Virginia, American Association, AAA. And in August of 57, John McHale called me and says, we just gave Kansas City permission to talk to you. So go up in the press box and call Park Harrell, their general manager, and make arrangements to go out there. So before I called him, I called Emil Bazard. He asked him what I should do, things like that. He said, George, don't go there. It's a bad operation. And I'm in there. It's a bad field. I'm in there once or twice a month trying to get that field fixed for my friend Lou Boudreau, who was managing there. And he said, not only there, it's a bad operation, but in the springtime, it'll flood you out. And in the summertime, it gets so hot, it'll bake you out. And then so I made arrangements and went out there on Labor Day of 57 and went and checked the field. And it was really a bad field. I mean, players were even picking weeds out of the infield. And it was so bad. And the next day I went to Denver because the Yankees and the Hausman brothers had the Denver Bears. They wanted me to be the groundskeeper there. And it was a beautiful ballpark, a beautiful grass mountain background. So I went back to Charleston, West Virginia, and thought it over. And I thought it over, and I said, George, you better go to Kansas City, because if you screw it up, nobody will ever notice. So we went in there, and in about 4 months, we turned it around to be a good field.
Even the batting cage is modern design, and athletic hitters step in for pregame practice. Between licks, there is time to throw a little.
Do you remember what type of grass you used that first year?
Actually, it was almost all weeds, and I had a spray to weeds. So there was more reeds than grass, so the field was brown with the grass weeds dying. The sports writers and TV ran me out of town, but we brought it back in a couple of weeks. It was like oasis in the desert with Bermuda Sea. But at that stadium there, we had the Kansas City A's, and then we had the Kansas City Chiefs came there in 63, played on the same field. We had the Kansas City Spurs. The soccer team played on the same field. Pele played there. And then we had the Beatles concert there on the field in 65. But back in those days with the A's and the Royals, they said we had the best field in baseball. Then the Chiefs came and they said we had the best field in football. And Pele said that it was they played with the Cosmos, I mean, New York, that the second best field he ever played on. Where all those sports that we had, the thing is there being in Kansas City, being at the old Municipal Stadium and the Kansas City Royals, I never had an assistant. I never had anybody work all year. And I had to do most of the things by myself. But I had a good crew. And the thing of that is when the Chiefs came, they would put bleachers up about 50 rows high with big cranes called the Wolf Pack. And with all those sports and the bleachers, exhibition games, the Monarchs and the Indianapolis Clowns would play in there, Billy Graham, we never spent more than $1,000 a year on that field.
That's amazing. How would you do that?
So what we would do, I would use ryegrass in the fall. Then I'd kill that ryegrass out. And on Memorial Day, I'd start putting Bermuda seed down. And by 4th of July, we had an oasis on the desert.
Sitting in on the operation, proud as punch, will be the millions of baseball fans of the mighty Midwest who ask nothing better than a good clear day, a ticket in hand, and a chance to watch their Kansas City A's in action.
Players would talk, write books like Goose Goslin in his book. He says when he came to Kansas City, looked at the field when he was a rookie, he never seen such a beautiful field. And all of them, and the Yankees try to get me to go to New York with them and offer me a lot of money, but I don't want to live in a big city. And the players would say, what's the matter, George? You're a farm boy to live in, afraid to live in a big city. And one time I says, it's 50 cents to go around the bridge. He says, don't worry, we got $500 in the budget a month for you for that.
What were some of the things that made Municipal Stadium in Kansas City unique? Or what are some of the things that stood out to you, George, about that old ballpark?
Well, actually, the one thing, it was just a minor league ballpark for the Kansas City Blues, which was a New York farm club, Yankees, and Mano played there, Rosito, you know, Yogi Berra, and then they had the great Negro Stars play there, the Kansas City Monarchs. And then it was a 90-day wonder when they got baseball with just a single deck. And in 90 days, they added an upper deck. And then when Finley came, and people in Kansas City hated Finley with a passion. And I'll say this, in my I'm 94 years old, 81 years in this game, I never had a better owner than Charles O. Finley.
Now, while Charlie might have been known as someone who was tight with his money, he definitely went all out when it came to coming up with unique promotions and interesting things that would draw spectators into the ballpark. What were some of the things that he brought to Municipal Stadium there in Kansas City? I mean, you had the mule, right?
Right. Charlie owned the mule. We had a picnic area where we had monkeys and rabbits and pheasants. And then we had a lamb chop hill where the hill in center field was so steep and rocky you couldn't cut grass. So Charlie brought in sheep, and he put sheep up there. And we had to dye the sheep different colors. And we had a boy, Thomas Weekly, that would dress up like a shepherd for every game and be up there with the sheep. And Tommy went to New York to be on What's My Line. He was a sheep herder.
We've talked about this on the podcast before, but I want to hear it from you because I'm sure you were responsible for helping to install it. You have to tell me about Harvey the Rabbit. What was Harvey the Rabbit, and how did Harvey the Rabbit come to be at Municipal Stadium in Kansas City?
It was a little elevator that was set in the ground. Umpire would press the button. It was on top of the elevator. I thought there was Harvey the Rabbit. Then on top of his hat was a basket for the baseballs.
So Harvey, this mechanical rabbit, he's right behind home plate.
Right by home plate, about 12 feet from home plate. It was right at the edge of the grass. And I remember the first game with that rabbit. Charlie O. Finley put all kind of birds in that rabbit instead of baseballs. They were packed in there like sardines. So when the umpire pressed the button for the baseballs, the birds came out and pooped all over the umpire, and John Sullivan was catching for the Tigers. In the ninth inning of that game, John Sullivan hits a home run and beats us. And not only there, we had an automatic plate duster. We had a home plate, and there was about a little rubber, circle rubber in the middle. Underneath there was an air valve, and on top of the air valve was a rubber home plate where the umpire would have to just step down and the air would come up and blow the dirt off home plate. Never had to use a brush.
So you said money was hard to come by. Didn't you sell broken stadium seats to help pay for grass seed?
Yes, that's what we had. We didn't have any money at all. We go and get broken seats. We get cardboard from the concession stands, glass bottles, and we take them down to the junkyard, 18th and Vine, get money, and then we go buy grass seed. And the same thing was at Royal Stadium. We didn't have no money. So one day, Detroit comes to town, so I want to cut the grass in back of the scoreboard outside the stadium. It'll make everything look nice. I had one tractor, So I went up behind the scoreboard to get ready to cut, and the thing stalled and never stopped, and it wouldn't start. So it was right near the stadium club, where the stadium club was open for lunch, where people would come for lunch. I put profanity at that tractor. People coming out of the stadium heard me. So two people came to me. Heck, one of them is Norm Cash, the first baseman for the Tigers. He took a friend to lunch there. And he starts saying, "What happened, Joe?" I said, I want this place to look good. We don't have no equipment, no money, no nothing. He says, "Let me introduce you to my friend." He says, "This is Hilton Hayes. He's from Dallas, Texas. And he's the district manager for John Deere." So we start talking, and here Norm Cash helps the Royals. And Hilton Hayes gave us $750,000 worth of equipment a year. And every year they would take that equipment after the season, put it in parking lot A, and have their five state dealers come and bid on it. And they would give us brand new equipment every year, everything, grass cutters, blowers, air conditioner, tractors.
I know you had a lot of local kids who were working with you on the grounds crew at Municipal Stadium.
My ground crew was students, black students, 16 years old. And they were from Lincoln High School, which is across the street from the stadium. Then down the road was Central High School. They can drag that infield in 28 seconds perfect. They can put the tarp down in 45 seconds. Mel Allen would, Yankee broadcaster, say, "They shouldn't be on there. They should be in the Olympics."
And Charlie Finley, he took care of those kids too, right? Didn't he?
Charlie took care of them. It was time to go to school. He bought them clothes. And when the sports writers came into town, New York, Boston, we had a picnic area. The first trip in, Charlie would have a barbecue for him. Instead of the press room, he'd go into the picnic area and have a barbecue, and he took those kids in there to eat.
And if you knew a storm was coming, what would those kids do for you?
Well, actually, these kids were so good. They were so proud of that field that they would call their mother and fathers up and say, "Mom, it's going to rain. We're going to not cover the field, and we're going to sleep here tonight." And that's what they did. And now those students are 60, 70 years old. My wife had a call from Orman just a minute ago. But last fall, they had a reunion for me at the old stadium. There's a monument there now at 22nd Brooklyn, but it's all housing. And they presented me with the George P. Thoma and then some foundation for black students to become groundkeepers. But I say this all over the world when I'm interviewed. How did I get there? Well, it's like this. It wasn't for Charles O. Finley and the students. There would be no George Thoma. They're the people that made me.
It's honestly so refreshing, George, to hear you say something like that in this day and age where people are so quick to rush to take the credit for everything. I just admire that so much. So you were hired by the NFL to do the field for Super Bowl I.
From the Coliseum in Los Angeles, with sunny skies, temperature in the 70s, and what a day.
What was the biggest challenge for making sure that that surface would be playable?
We only had a week to get ready. But at that time, when Pete Rozelle came to Kansas City in November for a press conference to see a game between the AFL and the NFL, and they asked him what the difference was within the play, he said, "I didn't see much difference in the play, but I never seen such a well-kept, beautiful playing field." And that was around Thanksgiving. And then Pete Rozelle asked me to do the Super Bowl and only had 5 days. I says, "Commissioner, what do you want on the 50-yard line?" He says, "George, it's your field. You do anything you want." And what I did, I came up with a center field. The logo was a big football with a crown on it and AFL and NFL.
And that moment would be the beginning of a decades-long partnership, now 50-some Super Bowls later, that you have been a part of. George, thank you so much for taking time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, no problem, and have a good one, and may all your good fortune this year and next year and all the coming years be as numerous as blades of grass, whether it be natural or artificial. God bless you.
That guy, like some of the other gentlemen we've had on from that era, thinking about Carl Erskine, the very first episode of the podcast, Roy Face, who was a member of the 1960 world champion Pittsburgh Pirates, they are just cut from a different cloth, right? And he in particular is one of a kind. And his contributions to the world of groundskeeping cannot be overstated. In fact, when I was doing research for this particular episode, I discovered that I think he's a member now of eight different Hall of Fames. Just an incredible life. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by Kyle Schmidt, Ryan Beard, Mike Lipinski, Xavier Guerra, Briggs Buckingham, Alex Kemp, John Carter, Mike Dunn, and Manny Zavlakis. Thanks for listening. Looking forward to being back with you next week for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.